Hello, my name is Jody Limat, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. On this twice-monthly podcast, I interview other kids' books enthusiasts, such as writers, teachers, and librarians, about their own favorite children's books. As I promised, I've returned with a podcast this August 1st. I plan to keep it going to the end of the year and beyond that, before taking another break. I don't know yet when that might be, but I'll keep you informed. If I plan to take a break, I'll let you know well ahead of time. I'm going to keep my introduction brief this time. I just want to repeat something I've mentioned on the last podcast, which is if you like this podcast or any of the other ones I've done, please go to my website, jlimat.com, and leave a comment. If you want your message to be private, I have a contact form you can fill out. And as always, if you're someone who's interested in kids' books, or you just know somebody like that, please drop me a line about a favorite book you'd like to talk about. We'll figure out a time to make that happen. My guest today is author Allison Tate, author of the middle grade adventure series The Mapmaker Chronicles, which includes the books Race to the End of the World, Prisoner Blackhawk, Breath of the Dragon, and the recently published Beyond the Edge of the Map. She's also host of the podcast series So You Want to Be a Writer, along with Valerie Koo of the Australian Writer Center, which is available on iTunes. You can find Allison's website at allisontate.com and the website for her book series at themapmakerchronicles.com. Thank you for joining me, Allison.
Thank you very much for having me.
Even though it probably sounds to listeners that we're in the same room talking to each other, there's actually a bit of distance between us. I'm talking from my home in New York State. And where are you speaking from?
Well, your listeners may, as soon as I start to actually speak a little bit more, might be able to hear that our accents are slightly different. I'm actually speaking to you from the south coast of New South Wales, and I am about 2 hours' drive south of Sydney in Australia. So we are, you know, as far as points on the map go, we are fairly distant.
And I know, at least from my point of view, you're speaking from either, I can't remember if it's tomorrow or yesterday, at least from my own particular time.
I'm speaking from tomorrow morning. I'm coming back at you from the future. How weird is that?
Very interesting.
It's so weird, isn't it, when you think about it? Like, I'm sitting here and it's actually winter in Australia at the moment. And I mean, you guys would laugh, but we're cold because it's about 10 degrees and Celsius. And we are, it's sunny and it's morning and I've got my coffee. And I know that you are probably, you know, ready for bed.
Oh, well, getting there anyway, getting there. Actually, that weather sounds like a pretty good spring day in New York.
Yeah, I know. And here we are all freezing to death, you know.
Now, I mentioned you've written this series called The Mapmaker Chronicles. For readers who might not be familiar with it, what can you tell them about it?
Oh, okay. So The Mapmaker Chronicles is a middle grade adventure sort of fantasy series. It's for boys and girls. It's about a race to map the world and a boy who really doesn't want to go, who finds himself on this epic adventure. And our hero, Quinn, is kind of the least likely person ever to be on such an adventure. But he has a secret, and that secret is something that ensures that he will be on this adventure, which is a good thing for me as a writer, because otherwise it would have been a very, very short book. And it started out as, you know, like this idea that grew and grew and grew, and now there are four books in the series. And the first three books are actually are now available in the US. You can get them via the publisher's website at Usborne Books and More, and they are very exciting and they've been really well reviewed, and I'm so incredibly grateful that I had an idea that turned out to be, you know, so amazing.
Where did you get the idea for writing this series?
Well, I always like to tell this story because I often go out and speak at schools. Obviously, I'm a children's author and I do a lot of workshops and I do a lot of author talks. And I'm always standing there telling these kids, you know, ideas are all around you and you just have to train yourself to see them. And the idea for the Mapmaker Chronicles actually came from two conversations that I had with my son, who was 9 years old at the time. And my son is one of those children, remains that. He's now 13. And he's still this kid, but he's one of those kids that likes to ask the head-hurting questions, you know, the ones where you know, if you actually start to think about them, your brain literally starts to explode and you have to leave the room. He's that kid. So, you know, the two conversations that we had happened very close together. The first one was when I decided it was a summer's night, and we do summer very, very nicely down here on the south coast of New South Wales. So we have kind of big black velvety skies, you know, with a million stars because there's not a lot of light pollution. So I decided that my son, Joe, and I were going to have a mother and son moment because I thought this is something he'll remember. So I dragged him out into the backyard, and we have quite a large backyard as well. I dragged him out into the backyard, which is probably a garden to you, and we stood out there and I was staring up at the stars. And, you know, it was like a really warm night and there was a balmy breeze and the crickets were down in the sort of garden sort of doing their crickety thing. And I'm thinking, this is lovely. Joe's going to remember this for the rest of his life. And we're staring out at the stars. And he turns to me and says, "Mum, how far does space go?" And I was like, way to ruin the mood, dude. And, you know, we started to talk about the fact that, you know, nobody knows. And every time they send out a probe or a rocket or whatever it is they send out, I'm not very scientific, they find, you know, more space and black holes and we're, you know, millions of light years from Earth and we still haven't found the edges. And if you start to think about what's at the edges, it kind of makes your head hurt. So I said to him the only thing that mums can ever say in such a moment, which is, we should go and Google that, which is pretty much what we did. We went inside and we Googled it. And of course, we found out that nobody knows. And he was happy enough with that. But the next night we were reading a series called Horrible Histories, which I'm sure are also widely available in the US. And it's a terrific series about all the not boring bits of history. And we were reading about explorers. And we were reading about, you know, how they pretty much died in all manner of interesting ways. And he said to me, oh, Mum, how did they map the world? And that wasn't such a weird question because I've always had an interest in antique maps. And, you know, I, as well as being the mum who will drag you out into the backyard to look at the stars, I'm also the mum who will drag you through dusty old exhibitions about maps and Incan gods and all sorts of stuff. So I said to him, well, you know, they had to go. They had to get in their ships and they had to sail out onto endless oceans and they were pretty sure they were going to die in some, you know, exciting and meaningful manner. But, you know, they had to go. And I said, and I had this, you know, that every once in a while as a parent, you just have this mum inspiration moment. And I said, they would have felt exactly the same way that we feel when we stare out into space. You know, they didn't know where the edges were. They thought there were monsters. They thought there were dragons, like we think there are aliens or whatever. And, you know, in that moment, I just was like, wow, that would make a great story. What would happen if you were someone who was, you know, on one of those ships and you didn't really want to be there? And so, yeah, from that, just from those two conversations, I ended up with this epic four-book, 250,000-word series with hopefully more books to come. So, yeah, I guess it's as a writer, you sort of like there are ideas everywhere. And I've been a features writer. I worked in magazines and newspapers for years and years, like for 20 odd years. And I think you get very, very good at listening to what's happening around you, what people are talking about, what are you looking at, what's happening in the news, and you find your feature ideas that way. And so for fiction authors, it's a very similar process, but it's a matter of recognizing those ideas when you have them. And the thing I find about ideas like that is that they generally are quite recognizable because you get a little bit of a thrill. There's a little tingle that says, ooh, this is the one sort of thing. So fortunately I had that with the Mapmaker Chronicles. And yeah, as I said, books 1 to 3 are now out in the US and they're in the UK and they're in Australia and they're in Lithuania and they're in Turkey. So they're sort of Quinn is out there traveling the world without me, which is a bit disappointing, but anyway.
Well, it sounds very interesting. Now, as well as being a writer, you also host a podcast titled So You Want to Be a Writer. The title's somewhat self-explanatory, but can you tell us a little bit about what this podcast is?
So the podcast is, as you said earlier, I co-host it with my friend Valerie Koo. Valerie Koo and I have used to work together in magazines many years ago, and we have reconnected over the years. And she is the founder of the Australian Writers' Centre, which runs a whole range of online courses and different things. And we would find that we would be chatting like once a week, because I also, you know, teach some courses there, and I also run a lot of the social media for the Australian Writers' Centre. And we would be chatting once a week, and we would be discussing the writing industry, and we would be talking about all the different things that were going on. And then about 3 years ago, she said, oh, we should totally do a podcast about this, these conversations that we have. And I'm like, oh, Val, who's going to want to listen to us talk about that? But as it turns out, lots of people do, because we are now 180 episodes into our podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer. And basically, we do two episodes a week, one of which is probably around sort of it depends on the author interviews, but between 40 to sort of 60 minutes long. And we talk about various things that are going on in the writing world. We answer questions, give writing advice, but we also every week interview an author about their writing process, about, you know, how they came to be published, about you know, their books. And it's a really interesting exercise, you know, even for someone who's been writing as long as I have and has put out, you know, several books, talking to other authors, I learn something new every single week. It's like I'm going to university, because I'm getting the best, you know, I get to ask the questions. So the podcast covers that in one episode a week. And then we also do a mini-sode, which usually comes out on a Friday. And it's basically where we answer listener questions. So listeners will send us specific questions, and we will answer those. And sometimes we'll have a mini interview, and sometimes it's just us answering three or four questions. So it's a big time commitment, a podcast, and I'm sure that you would also know that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also it's a very, very rewarding. And the community, I think one of the best things about the So You Want to Be a Writer podcast is the community that has grown up around it. We have regular listeners who talk to each other, who've all met each other online and sort of, you know, network with each other through Twitter and Facebook and different things. And will, you know, obviously comment to us regularly via social media about the podcast and what we've talked about. And it's very, very rewarding as well. So we love doing it. And we just really hope that people like to listen to it. So if you'd like to listen to it, you'll find it on iTunes or your podcast aggregator of choice, and you just need to search So You Want to Be a Writer.
I know it might be hard to narrow it down, but if you could offer one little bit of advice or suggestion to writers just starting out on their craft, what might it be?
Well, my first piece of advice for everyone is always finish the book, because a lot of people talk about writing. There's a lot of talking about writing is very fun, and I know this because I do it a lot. So there's a lot of people who talk about writing a book, and or they'll start writing and they'll get three chapters in and it gets very, very hard. But you need to finish a manuscript, because everybody writes a book differently, and the way that I go about writing a book would be different to the way that you would go about writing a book, but you will never know what your process is unless you get to the end. So it's one of those things where my advice is always, if you really want to be a writer, you actually have to write. You can't just talk about it. You have to get to the end of the manuscript, because the beauty of writing, and there's two things. When I go to my author talks, I always say to kids, there's two things that I love most about writing. One of those things is that I get to control the entire world when I write. Like it's, you know, nothing happens in that world unless I want it to happen, although my characters would disagree with me on that sometimes. But, you know, basically, you know, nobody gets to control the whole world anywhere except when they're creating the work. And that's one of the joys of writing. But the other thing that I love about writing is that you can fix it. You know, as they say, it's not like brain surgery. You don't have to get it right the first time. And the importance of actually just getting that first draft done cannot be underestimated. So that's you know, like if you listen to the podcast, you will hear me bang on about that on a regular basis. I'm sure people get so sick of me, but they also come back to me and say, I can hear your voice in my head saying, just sit down and write this thing. And I think if I'm doing that for one writer, then, you know, my work is done. I'm pretty happy with that.
I think that's a good piece of advice. Now, the book you chose as one of your favorites is a book which I was not familiar with myself. The title is Storm Boy by Colin Feel. It was first published in 1963 by Rigby Adelaide, and more recently a 50th anniversary edition came out by New Holland Press. For those readers who might not be familiar with this book, what can you tell them about it?
Well, it's one of those books that I think it's very much a part of the Australian consciousness. It's one of those books that pretty much everybody, like, it's really interesting because I reread the book, you know, in preparation for this conversation. And I think one of the most important things that I need to let you know about this book is that I read it when I was about 10. It traumatized me to the point where I was never able to read it again. I wrote about this on Facebook yesterday, how I'd reread this book as an adult. And so many people responded in the comments saying that book broke my heart. And I think the reason that it's stuck with me for so long is that it's the first book that I remember making me cry. And I think that if a book makes you cry, then it's a very special work of art. And it's the kind of book that it's not just me, like everybody says that book made me cry. And it's a really interesting story because in my memory of this book, it looms so large in my mind that I was very surprised when I picked it up again as an adult as to just how short it was. Like, it's really only like it's a you know, extended short story in some ways. So it's not a big book, but it leaves a very, very big impression. So it's basically about a boy who lives on a, you know, sort of on a deserted beach in Western Australia with his father. And his father is essentially a hermit after the boy's mother, who is known as Storm Boy the whole way through after his mother died. And it's essentially just a little story. It almost reads like a fable or a legend about a boy who finds, an injured pelican. The pelican has been orphaned with two siblings by people who, you know, are shooters on the beach. And the boy finds these three pelican chicks and he raises them and then they go to let them out in the wild. And one of them, Mr. Percival, comes back. And it's about the relationship between the boy and the bird. And it's about what happens, you know, within that relationship. But I think one of the things that I love most about the book, apart from the fact that the story is heartbreaking, is the sense of place. I think it's a very Australian book. And I don't think I even realized how incredibly Australian it was until I read it again. But the sense of place that is evoked in the book is the kind of thing that even like an 8 or 10-year-old recognises as being something that's quite special, because the language is relatively simple. It's not a complicated read on any level, but it is just evocative and beautiful. And I think that obviously as a reader, as a child, I was drawn to that and recognised that without even sort of realising that that's what was going on.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a short book. It's not a picture book, but it's almost like a short story with illustrations. And you just mentioned, you know, the language in the here. It's very poetic and it conveys a lot.
Well, as I said, I think there's a lyricism to the language. As you say, there's almost a poetry to it. There's a rhythm to it. It's not overstated. It's kind of just there. But it is used to build this picture. And I think that that's the other thing about the book, is that the picture of the world in which Storm Boy lives is built, you know, page by page, word by word. I feel as though, you know, looking at it again now as an adult, there's nothing extraneous in it. And I think that that is something that is many, many authors could probably learn from, particularly now with, you know, books seem to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. There's nothing extraneous in it, and yet the heart of the story is not lost because of that. In fact, if anything, I think the heart of the story is brought out even more. Like, I read this again, you know, but when I read it the first time, it was just, I was honestly weeping buckets, like to the point where my mum was just like, what's the matter? And I'm going, oh, this and that, and there, Mr. Percival, and blah, blah, blah. You know, I couldn't even speak. I was incoherent. And even just reading it again yesterday, you know, I had tears in my eyes. It is a level of a bond that is evoked within the language that is just simply built up piece by piece, word by word, until you get to the end. And the last line is just, I mean, do we do spoilers in this? I'm not exactly sure how much I should
reveal. I'll leave that up
reveal.
To you.
Well, I'll put it this way. The last line of the book is just, it gets me every single time. And I think it's actually quite fitting. So I will read you the last line of the book. For birds like Mr. Percival do not really die. This is a line that I think, you know, could be, it sums up, I think, the legacy of the book in some ways as well, because this is a book that has, as you say, has been around since 1963, continues to be picked up, continues to be read, and has long lived on in the memories of many, many people that I know. So it's a powerful, powerful book, and the language, I think, is what builds to make it so.
This book also joins a large number of other books that describe this special relationship that develops between a child and an animal. I think of books like The Yearling, Shiloh, and so on. And what do you think the particular appeal of this theme that seems to be revisited over and over again in books?
That's a really interesting question. My son Joe of the Head Hurting Questions, he has a book blog called bookboy.com.au where he reviews books. And he recently reviewed a book called Pax, which is about a boy and a fox. And it was an interesting thing because, you know, he's a 13-year-old boy and it got sent in for him to read. And I thought, well, I wonder how he'll go with this. And he absolutely loved it. He just, you know, and he wrote a review about it that was glowing. And it was about the use of the language and it was about the, you know, the bond. And I think it's that thing of particularly that age group. They seem to often be aimed at that middle grade sort of age group where we're not really up to love yet, but we are still loving. And I think that that bond between a child and a pet is about one of the purest forms of love that we have, and particularly at that, you know, at that age. And I think that it's, I think the trust with an animal in the sense, like I have a dog who's known to the world as Procrastipup. He is my writing companion. And I've had him for about, he's now 3 years old, and he joined our family, you know, when he was about 10 weeks old. And, before we got the dog, I didn't want the dog. I thought, I've got two boys. I can't be the mum who doesn't let the boys have a dog, you know. Like it's, but all I could think about was pet hair and, you know, walking and all of those different things. And then we have the dog. And I have to say, at the moment, I think the dog is pretty much my favourite member of the family. You know, that does change on a daily basis. But I think there is something about that sort of unwavering trust and unconditional love that you get from a pet like that, that children understand. They understand that sort of love, and I think that is the reason that those sorts of books just resonate so greatly with kids of that age.
In this book, there are basically three main human characters along with Mr. Percival, the pelican. And each of these people, they have a bond with each other and a bond with the pelican. But at the same time, they're isolated in their own way, and they're all outcasts in different ways. And what did you think about this idea of this isolation that all these characters seem to, even when they're together, they seem to be somewhat isolated from each other?
Again, I think that was an interesting thing too, because you know, you notice that reading it as an adult. When I read it as an adult, I noticed that they're very sad. Like it's a very sad sort of, you know, like there's a whole lot of people in this book, the three of them, dealing with their own isolation sort of together. And I found that very interesting as an adult. Now, as a child, though, you read that and it's just what it is, isn't it? I mean, you notice that sense of isolation, and perhaps that's one of the reasons that the book affected me so deeply. Was I remember I read it not long after. So I spent the formative years of my childhood in the Northern Territory of Australia, up in sort of Alice Springs, and very, very different environment. You know, it's like a desert environment up there. And then we moved as a family when I was about 10. We moved to the south coast of New South Wales. So we're, you know, I'm now sort of, at that stage, I'm now 2 hours south of Sydney. I'm at the beach, which, you know, is unheard of when you've grown up in Alice Springs. And I was entering, I think, grade 5, so I was just starting in that sort of middle school. As anyone will ever tell you, it is the worst time ever to start school, you know, to join a new school. And so I was, I think, feeling, oh, and my mum was having a baby. There you go. So it was a big year now that I look back on it. It was a massive year. And I think that I read the book at a time when I was probably feeling, you know, even if I wasn't articulating it, I was probably feeling very isolated myself. And I suspect that that's probably why this book affected me as much as it did as a child, and I think that's possibly why it stayed with me, because I think the books that we read as children, if you pick up the right book at the right time, it can be, you know, your best friend, it can be a lesson, it can be all of the things, you know, it can be an escape, you know, depending on what you need at any given time. So I feel like the isolation of these characters is very obvious as an adult. As a child, though, I saw the three of them and the pelican as being more of a sort of like, yes, they weren't part of main society, but they had each other. And I think that, again, it's the reading as an adult and reading as a child thing of children's fiction is always such an interesting exercise. I remember reading a couple of years ago, I read The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton, which, of course, is a more of a YA novel. But I read it before because I wanted to give it to my son. He's a good reader, and I wanted to give it to my son. And I wanted to read it again before I gave it to him. Now, I remember reading that as a teenager and just thinking it was amazing. And, you know, like obviously it was very sad as well. But the way that the boys lived at that stage seemed to me to be, you know, quite cool. You know, they were all there. There were no parents. Okay, they were a gang. They were sort of going to do their thing. And I read it as an adult, and I felt so sad for them. Like, I felt so sorry for the older brother, Daryl, in that book, who was trying to manage these younger brothers and a job and keep them off the streets. And, you know, so I think it's important when you read a book as an adult to think about the fact that kids read differently depending on where they're up to at any point in their lives. And I think that's something to remember as well. Sorry, I've completely lost track of the question now because I'm raving on about other books.
Perfectly okay. I did have another question for you, though. We talked a little bit about the setting is very specifically Australian. It's very evocative. And I'm wondering, apart from the place itself, is there anything else about this book that makes it uniquely Australian?
See, that's an interesting question, too. You're very good at interesting questions. That's yes, thanks for that. The place is obviously a key to it in many ways. There's the character, obviously, of Fingerbone Bill, the Aboriginal or Indigenous man, is a very Australian, obviously a very Australian aspect to the book as well. I was reading, again, his character with a great deal of interest as well because, obviously, I read this book for the first time, you know, back in the 1970s, which is a completely different political and cultural climate in Australia to what it is now. So reading that character again was quite an interesting thing too. And when I read it as a child, it was like oh, this is an interesting insight. And, you know, he was just a character. But the way that Colin Teal uses the language of that character is interesting and is probably wouldn't be written the same way now. If he was to write the book now, he may not write an Aboriginal character in quite the same way as he has written it in this particular instance. But I do feel that the way it's written in this book, the way that Fingerbone Bill is written in this book is very much, you know, an insight into Australian culture at the time and insight into Indigenous culture. And I think that was quite interesting. That made it quite Australian. The relationship, I think, between the three characters to their section of the land felt very Australian to me as a child and probably even as an adult as well. But I think mostly it's just the author has just created a stunning sense of place in this book, and I feel like the landscape is treated almost as another character. Like, you feel the storms, you feel the beach, you feel all of those things because, of course, Mr. Percival and his siblings come out of that landscape, and I think that, you know, Mr. Percival looms such a big character for a bird, you know, in the book, that, you know, the fact that he has come out of this landscape makes the landscape more evocative as well.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning that this book had recently its 50th year anniversary printing. Most children's books that come out never achieve that kind of longevity. What is it about this book that still speaks to both kids and adults, even after all these years?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So when I put up my post on Facebook to say that I had read the book again and, you know, like, it was still an incredible story and it was still made me cry, I think the fact that it is such a profoundly moving story about such a profoundly Australian place has just made it live on. It is the book that many, many people will remember as the first book that made them cry. And I think that if you hold that place in the hearts of generations of readers, they're never going to forget you. And I think that's what's happened with this book. You don't forget this book. And, you know, as I said, I read it when I was, you know, 10 years old. And even though I could never actually bring myself to read it again, I never forgot this book. And I feel like it's an incredible achievement as an author to create a story that is, on the surface of it, quite a simple tale that has just got such layers of emotion involved in it. It's very difficult to evoke a feeling in a reader, and this author has evoked feelings in generations of readers who never forget the book. And, you know, to create something like that is just an incredible achievement.
Is there a particular passage from the book that you'd like to share?
Well, I thought about that because it's actually quite a difficult. Some of the most evocative passages in the book are, of course, the climax passages, which I don't really want to share. I would be interested to know whether, I mean, you read it as an adult, I guess, which is a slightly different thing. But, I mean, as a tale, as I said, it's quite a simple tale, etc. But is it an Australian thing that we're also, you know, traumatized by this book, or does it reach other continents?
Oh no, I think it's very much the story it tells has very much a universal appeal, and I think reading as an adult, you pick up more on that, as you talked about, that sort of that undercurrent of sadness that sort of goes through it, and particularly in the ending, you know, and what happens to Storm Boy. It's sort of unexpected, at the same time, it's completely expected. What happens to him? I mean, I was kind of curious about what makes it uniquely Australian, but it's definitely a book I think that would have a lot of appeal for kids here for a lot of those reasons, because stories with kids and animals in general are just very appealing. That relationship is just so unique. So I definitely think it has that universal appeal to it.
It's an interesting thing too, because I think reading it as an adult too, I can see that while, you know, what happens to Mr. Percival was a heartbreaking thing, I felt that almost the consequences of that, of Storm Boy's, you know, decision to leave at that point is, I feel like maybe that's almost the thing that really tore me apart, was this sense of him, this whole place, this which was him. You know, he is very much a part of this place. He is, you know, integral to it. It is integral to him, and he leaves it behind. And leaves his, you know, leaves his father, who is still standing there at the post, you know, waiting for him to come back at the school holidays. I think that it's that sense of leaving everything that was possibly, maybe that's the undercurrent that really does us all in. I'm not exactly sure, but it's because the sense of place builds. You know, the Storm Boy's place in that sense of in that place builds, and you have this, you know, this sense of, okay, it's not exactly the normal world, but it's his world and he's at home in it and he's part of it, and then he's not. And I think that, you know, it's that whole sense as a child, as a 10-year-old, where, you know, and I often say this about, this is one of the reasons I love to write for this age group, because it's that idea of them, they're so on the cusp of the big adventures, you know, they're so on the cusp of the big adventures of the teenage years, and they know it's coming and they know they can't do anything to stop it, but some of them are very scared of it as well, and it's a very concerning time. And I think that's what makes them such an interesting age group to actually write stories for, is this notion that they're on the cusp of the greatest adventure, or one of the greatest adventures that we as humans go through. This notion of, you know, going through that, those teenage years and into adulthood, it's the biggest change that any of us ever undertake in our entire lives. And I feel like that's sort of some of what you feel in this book, is that sense of him leaving that childhood behind and going, you know, and that, look at me, I'm choking up just thinking about it. So I decided that I would just read a part of the book that just, you know, helps to evoke that sense of place. And it's a part of the book that sort of, you know, introduces us to the idea of the birds even before we have the birds, if you know what I'm saying. So, and the birds' place in the world and the landscape. So I thought I would just read a little bit of that to give an idea of the language and the lyricism, etc. Some distance from the place where Hideaway and Fingerbone had built their humpies, the whole stretch of the Coorong and the land around it had been turned into a sanctuary. No one was allowed to hurt the birds there. No shooters were allowed, no hunters with decoys or nets or wire traps, not even a dog. And so the water and the shores rippled and flapped with wings. In the early morning, the tall birds stood up and clapped and cheered the rising sun. Everywhere there was the sound of bathing, a happy splashing and sousing and swishing. It sounded as if the water had been turned into a bathroom 5 miles long, with thousands of busy fellows gargling and gurgling and blowing bubbles together. Some were above the water, some were on it, and some were under it. A few were half on it and half under. Some were just diving into it, and some just climbing out of it. Some who wanted to fly were starting to take off, running across the water with big, flat feet, flapping their wings furiously and pedalling with all their might. Some were coming into land with their wings breaking hard and their big webbed feet splayed out, ready to ski over the water as soon as they landed. Everywhere there were crisscrossing wakes of ripples and waves and splashes. Storm Boy felt the excitement and wonder of it. He often sat on the shore all day with his knees up and his chin cupped in his hands. Sometimes he wished he'd been born an ibis or a pelican. So I just really love, again, I think that every passage in the book, I could have chosen any one, which gives that idea of the lyricism, the poetry, you know, the sound. When you read it aloud, you get that sound of the waves, you know, almost in the words. And you get that notion of space and the idea of Storm Boy's place, you know, in that space. And I think that it's because that's something that I think people are often, I mean, I know America also, the United States, you have massive wide open spaces as well. So you guys probably have more of an understanding of it than many. But so people come to Australia and they cannot get over that sense of space. And if you go out into, you know, if you go to some of the less inhabited areas, it's overwhelming. The space is overwhelming and you feel so small in the space. And, you know, that does people's heads in as well.
I do have to say I appreciated you reading that because when I read the book, and I enjoyed reading the book, but everybody in my head spoke with an American accent. So hearing that.
I know. I could almost just read the whole book out loud. It's so short. I could read the whole book out loud in an Australian accent and you might get a sense of, you know, what it sounds like to us.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Well, Allison, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me, and especially for sharing this book that is a brand new book to me.
Oh, you're most welcome, and thank you for the opportunity. It's always, I love talking about books, so, you know, I'm willing to talk about books at any stage, at the drop of a hat, any time.
Allison Tate's website can be found at allisontate.com, and the website for her book series at themapmakerchronicles.com. Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music titled All Together is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purpleplanet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can visit me at jleemott.com or follow me on Twitter at dreamgardensjlm. The Dream Gardens podcast is also available through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you like what you hear, please comment, share, or subscribe. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.